Okay, so today we want to talk about building superconducting quantum devices. And if you're going to do that, we need to start by saying a little bit about superconductivity. And so at the turn of two centuries ago, Kamerlingh's Onnes discovered how to liquefy helium. And so then you could get down to about 4 Kelvin. And over the next few years, up until about 1910, he learned how to pump on it. And of course, if you pump on a liquid, you have evaporative cooling. And so it depends on the mass, how cold you can get. For liquid helium, which is mainly helium-4, you can go from about 4.2 K to about 0.9 K if you pump really hard. For helium-3, you can go down to about 0.25 K. But of course, at that time, you didn't have the opportunity to separate helium-3 from helium-4 easily. And helium-3 is rare enough that it would be hard to get. But anyways, and they could get down to 0.9 Kelvin. And in 1911, famously, while he was on vacation, his students discovered superconductivity in mercury. And the reason for mercury is twofold. One, they wanted a really clean metal. It's hard to purify metals. And of course, you can distill mercury. And even more so, they wanted to make a really clean contact to the metal. And of course, with mercury, you don't have to solder anything. You can stick leads into it. So they can make a really clean contact. And of course, what they saw was this dramatic drop to zero resistivity at just above 4 Kelvin. And superconductivity is, is of course a surprising effect that you can remove the resistance completely. And it's a profound and dramatic effect. In the lab, we have superconducting magnets that there are big spools of superconducting wire. If you have a spool of wire, you need to insulate something, insulate it. So we use copper as an insulator because you might think it's a good conductor, but compared to a superconductor, it's a bloody poor conductor. So we build superconducting wires that have superconducting filaments in them surrounded by copper. And we put a current through there. In a big superconducting magnet, we may have 300 amps of current flowing through a bobbin of wire that is 60 or 100 Henry, depending upon what magnet it is. There's a lot of stored energy in these things. And after we charge the magnet, we just, underneath the helium, we close the switch. We make it a continuous loop of current. And then we remove the leads, and it stays charged. It stays charged for decades. And the magnetic field is maintained for decades. Superconducting is really superconducting. So now then, fine. 1911, superconductivity is discovered. It takes quite a few years for it to be explained. But for many materials, we understand how superconductivity works. We'll talk a little bit about that. And of course, for some materials, high-TC superconductors, you don't really know how it works. And so it's still an area of interest. But for us, we want to look at just a little bit of the physics of superconductivity. We don't really care too much about the mechanism. And so we can start by asking, what is the properties of a superconducting ring? So I give us a ring of superconducting materials. And would take really as an onset that that the wave function looks like this. Okay, so the wave function depends on the current density. Well, actually, I want to say the particle density. That is not a function of location. It's a constant. It's a number. And some phase. And of course, the expectation is that because there's no scattering, then we don't have to put in any additional physics. Now, of course, when this was developed by Bardeen Cooper Schreiber, it was a novel idea of using this as a wave function. Today, it's not so novel that if you look in your laptop, most of the electron flow is ballistic. So most of the transport of electrons between transistors in your laptop happens without scattering, just because the lengths are very short. So if you get down to about 80 nanometers of length, then you have ballistic transport. And so that, of course, also happens without without scattering. And it might surprise you. You say, well, why does my laptop get hot? Right? You know, you have ballistic transport, so there's no scattering. Your laptop gets hot because of the uncertainty of when an electron arrives at the device. And so there's an apparent resistance that comes from the energy-time uncertainty relationship in the absence of scattering. And so that gives a fundamental resistance to all of the wires in your laptop. And that we should get rid of someday. It's pretty fundamental, however. But there are some tricks. Anyways, let's go back to this. So we have this ring. We have a wave function that we're going to take. And the most useful thing here is to look at the current density of this. And so the current density, and of course here we're still assuming electrons, is related to the gradient operator. And so we can calculate the current density of this, of course, the charge and mass of the electron. Now, if I have a ring, then this can't be the whole story, because I can have flux. I can have a magnetic field in this ring. Okay, so we can add a magnetic field. And if we want to understand the current density, then of course, I need to add the field to this. And it's nicest to add it in terms of the vector potential, right? And so you'll remember that the field is related to the vector potential. And so we can change this and replace del with the term including the vector potential. Okay. So now we can expand this out. We know the wave function. And we end up with the current density having this nice simple result. here. Now the current density, well, this is a continuous featureless ring. So the current density better be zero. In that structure. So this gives us a simple picture of the vector potential. So now we have the vector potential in terms of del of the phase of the wave function around this ring. And we can go ahead and integrate that phase around the ring. And so I can say, ah, yes, I can calculate the total phase around the ring. No,
okay.
It turns out not to be that the phase can be, of course, given by position. But the particle density is uniform. And that is the most important ansatz in this. That would say nothing new can arise. There's no scattering events. So you have no right to choose one location and say that one's special. Okay, so now then we have the total magnetic flux through that ring. We go back and we relook at this wave function. And we ask a couple things of a wave function. The first thing we ask is that it be continuous. There's no delta function potentials or anything crazy here, right? Just a continuous ring, so the wave function better be continuous. And it must be single values. So we're left with a very simple piece that the phase can only vary by integer multiples of 2 pi over the ring. And those integers cannot be zero, right? Because if the integers were zero, then it wouldn't be single valued over the ring. And so, therefore, we make a simple prediction. That the magnetic flux, the total magnetic flux contained within a superconducting ring should be integer values of H over E. And this was known quite early. It was known already in the 20s. It took a while, but eventually the experiment was done. And what it was found is for a superconductor, there's this bloody factor of 2 there. So when the experiment was carried out, it's clearly shown that what was going on with the superconductor was that the charge was being carried, that the current element had a charge of 2 electrons. And of course, this is a very surprising feature. That electrons repel each other. And so one asks, how is it possible that they're conducting in pairs? And that 2, of course, is the well-known Cooper pair. Now, we're not going to need to know, fortunately, BCS theory, because it's complicated. We take the rest of the semester, and we still wouldn't get through it. But it's useful to have one little piece of it. You know, it always helps to have some model. And what BCS theory says is that you have a lattice. And let's just imagine the lattice in a metal. And somewhere, there's an electron. And the electron's going to distort the lattice. So what will happen is that all of these nuclei, all these atoms, because they're positively charged, are going to be drawn towards the electron. And then if I have another electron sitting out over here, it won't see a negative charge from the electron. You'll see an effective positive charge because of the lattice distortion caused by that electron. So because the electron's sitting far enough away, what it sees is, of course, the distortion, the overall distortion. It doesn't see the individual electron. And so there is a small, very small, attractive potential between those two electrons. Okay. Now it's small, so that if you want to see this, you better be at low temperature. And, of course, it's small. So the pairing energy of the two electrons matter. So they should be anti-aligned. And you could think about this very nicely, and today it's profitable to do that, as having an effective boson, an emergent boson, coming out of this pairing. And then you can think of a Bose condensate of this process, yeah? So if you've done that, you know, you can think about it. But this is the mechanism that one's going to use to understand superconductivity, at least in materials like mercury. Now, having said that, first, you can understand, perhaps, why superconductors tend to be poor classical conductors, right? So that if you look at it, what's a good superconductor? Aluminum, mercury, niobium. You can have 10. They're alloys. The reason you need a poor conductor in this model to have a good superconductor is I need there to be a strong interaction between the electron and the lattice. Whereas if I have a good conductor, I want there to be no interactions between the electron and the lattice. I want the electrons to be truly free. Okay, so we have this dichotomy that if I want to have a good superconductor, I need something that's a conductor, but it should be a poor conductor because the lattice interaction should be important. Now, given all of this, Brian Josephson, wanted to look at what would happen for a tunnel junction made out of a superconductor. So Josephson looks at this device. Take two pieces of aluminum, so they're good conductors, and grow a very thin layer of aluminum oxide in between, which is a very good insulator. And you can make it thin. And so that here we have a superconducting tunnel junction. And to remind you, if I have a tunnel junction, I have some wave function on the left, then there's a possibility of it tunneling through and having some amplitude of it on the right. And we can define the tunneling probability. You can calculate the tunneling probability. of this stuff you've seen before, and it doesn't matter, actually. But it gives you a sense of the physics. Okay, so we have the tunneling probability. There's some energy of the wave function. There's some potential height. There's the mass of the electron. There's a width of this potential, right? And so you can put all these three things through here, and you see the tunneling junction. So he's looked at this. And he looked at the tunnel junction for this same wave function, right? Okay, so he's doing this before everything's figured out. But he says, okay, I know the wave function. I know what happens under tunneling. And therefore, I can ask the question. And his analysis isn't the most clever and complete. And later on, Feynman cleans it up. But we don't need to go through his math. He comes up with two effects. The first one says that the current through the device is a sinusoidal function of the phase. And now this phase is the phase difference over the Josephson junction. So we now take his tunnel junction and rename it after him. We have this first effect, okay, that says that the current difference, that the current is a sinusoidal function of the phase difference. And the second effect is that the time derivative of the phase depends upon the voltage over the junction. All right, so this is the voltage over the Josephson junction. Now, this is about 1961. Bardeen, Cooper, and Shreve have just completed understanding their theory. The rest of the community doesn't really understand it yet. Josephson is a graduate student working for Pippard. And he goes and he tells him this nice result. And what Pippard says is, you're exactly right. Only when the Cooper pairs tunnel through this, they will tunnel as individual electrons. They'll break their pairing. And so the tunneling amplitude will now be the square of this term. And this term is already small, so you'll never see it. Okay. Would have been a really complicated physics to say, oh no, we have some physics here, some physics there, and some physics there. And we're going to just treat it as a tunnel process. But anyways, that's what his thesis advisor told him. And then Bardeen had an even more brutal statement that the junction would break the pairing, so that it would no longer be Cooper pairs, period. And so he said, not that the effect would be there, but small, but the effect wouldn't be there at all, and you wouldn't be able to see this. Okay, both of those guys were wrong, of course. And, you know, it's a bit of a drag for Pippard because, you know, the student wins the Nobel Prize. I mean, it started off that way, right? Kamerling's student did the experiment to win the Nobel Prize. with camera lens said, good work. So he gets the Nobel Prize. You know, Rapard student does his stuff to get the Nobel Prize. Rapard said, oh, no, that's not right. So his student gets the Nobel Prize, not him. So now then, let's see what this predicts. The first thing it predicts is the so-called DC Josephson effect. And it says, let's take a Josephson junction. And we're going to label our Josephson junctions like this. So that's the circuit symbol for Josephson junction. It's not the diode. It's not some fancy diode. Okay? It's the Josephson junction. So now we'll have our Josephson junction. I'll put a voltmeter over it. And we'll put the current source. Let's call it V. We'll put a current through this. And you get to a very simple thing. Well, I mean, classically, of course, no current flows. Remember that no current flows through a voltmeter, because a voltmeter ideally has infinite resistance, right, internally. And no current would flow through here, because, of course, it's a Thelen junction. It has effectively an open resistance, right? So there's infinite resistance there. Infinite resistance plus infinite resistance is still infinite resistance, no current flows. According to Josephson's equation, what happens is that the current flows. And the current flows, and it sets this phase. So this phase is determined by the ratio IDC over IC, the critical current. Now, the critical current is an engineering parameter. It's related to the materials. It's related to the details of how you build the junction. It's related to the quality of the material in the junction, but it's a constant. You have some device, you can measure it. And how do you measure it? Well, you do exactly this experiment. And as long as your choice of IDC is lower than the critical current, there'll be no voltage. So the amazing thing is that this tunnel junction, naively we would think, oh, it's a tunnel junction, it should have a really small current. But it doesn't. As long as the critical current, as the current we're trying to pass through, is smaller than the critical current, it looks like a superconducting wire. It doesn't interrupt the flow of Cooper pairs at all. Okay, so the DC Josephson effect says that the JJ looks like a superconducting wire. Under this particular requirement, that the current we're passing through it is small compared to the critical current. And if we have a DC Josephson effect, then we should have an AC Josephson effect, right? So let's talk about the AC Josephson effect. Okay. So now then I'm going to put a voltage and we're going to measure the current through a Josephson junction. We apply a voltage. And of course now we can look at the second equation, right? Because here we've defined the voltage and we see that d phi dt is equal to 2e over h bar v, right? So that, and the voltage is just a constant voltage, it's a DC voltage. So that phi is equal to 2e h par v times t. This is also a strange relation. It says, take a Josephson junction, bias it with a constant voltage. Just put a battery across it. Okay? And then the phase across the Josephson junction varies linearly in time. But the current, of course, varies as a sign of that phase. Right? So now then, we can write out the current through this device. Okay, so now that we get an oscillating current in the device, just by applying a DC field. And of course I can express this in terms of a frequency, right? So the frequency is equal to 2e over h par times the voltage. And this piece here is about 4 times 10 to the 14 hertz. Per volt. Right, so we've made an oscillator of the current by applying DC voltage, and we get out to frequency, which is typically in the gigahertz range. Right, we're usually looking at fractions of a volt in these devices. Yep. Josephson reported these two simple outcomes of his analysis. And then in a conference in England, they had this extraordinary event where Josephson was asked to debate with Bardeen about whether this was true or not. So, you know, it's sort of an awkward thing, right? You take the grand old man of the field and some graduate student, and you say, okay, we'll put you in front of the audience and you two can have a debate about who's right. And it went well. I don't think Josephson convinced many people, but he did convince Phil Anderson to go and look at this. You've probably heard of Phil Anderson as a theorist, but he can influence experiments too. He was at Bell Labs at the time. They did the experiment and they saw it right away. That in fact, these effects are there. They're easy effects to see in the lab today. Somewhat harder than, and so, okay. Everything was fine. Now, so far what we've said is that we have some nice new physics. And the nice new physics gives us these pieces that look like we have a non-linearity in the device. And so then you would think, well, okay, why should we make a quantum circuit out of this? Well, we're going to make a quantum circuit out of it, in our case, because if I want to have a qubit, I need to bring something nonlinear into the process, right? And so what I would like to have is some potential that locally looks like it's going to confine a few energy levels so that I can write my qubit on a couple of those. And of course, remember that we don't want a truly harmonic potential, because I need to have an energy separation between those levels in order to have control. If it's truly a ladder structure, then we can't write a qubit into the dynamics of the system. You know, if that's not obvious to you, let me say it quickly. Let's say we started off in the zero state in a harmonic oscillator. Clearly, we could excite to the one state. Then let's say I want to derive that system to go back here. Well, what I'm going to do is, in fact, I'm going to connect to both of those levels, right? Because the energy separation is exactly the same. It's only the energy separation that appears in the Hamiltonians, right? And so if we take a harmonic system, it's very hard to control the system to keep it in two levels. And there's nothing magical about the number two, right? And you say, well, why a qubit? It's nice because it maps onto bits, and so we can think about it. You know, if it was a three-level system, that would be fine too. But it needs to have a tensor product structure. And so if it's an infinite number of levels, life is going to be a drag for control. And we will never achieve the efficiencies of a quantum computer. So here we say, oh yeah, when we use this, because I want to have this anharmonicity of the device. Now, there's something more than that. I mean, classically, we could build electronic circuits that have anharmonicity. But we believe in the superconducting world that will be able to suppress the noise. Let's see how that works. We've got this Josephson junction there. And there's lots of models for the Josephson junction. But the model that's most common, most useful, is to add in parallel a capacitor and a resistor. So we have a resistantly shunted Josephson junction with a capacitor. RC and JJ. And sometimes they will draw this. With the subscript, so that it means that. Okay. But let's just work with this circuit element for a second. So we say, oh yes, this is the perfect Josephson junction. Why a capacitance? Because the tunnel junction really is two parallel plates with a dielectric in between. So there truly is a capacitance there. Why a resistance? Because the insulator is never going to be perfect. Okay, so there'll always be some leakage current through that. Okay, so say, oh yes, here we have some leakage, here we truly have a capacitor, and there we have our Josephson junction. It sounds bad, right? says, look, I'm going to take and take this beautiful quantum device. And what am I going to do? I'm going to ruin it by allowing me to be sensitive to charge fluctuations. I'm going to ruin it by allowing me to be sensitive to a leakage current. Okay? But we come back over here. We say, oh, well, hold on. Not so quick. If I DC bias that device, then by DC biasing it with a current, the voltage across the junction is zero. If the voltage across the junction is zero, right, then I've effectively shorted out that capacitor. So there shouldn't be charge fluctuations. If the voltage across the resistance is zero, then there's no potential for having a leakage current, right? And so although these components are essential to the model, it's not in an electrical circuits case obvious that we're actually adding noise to the system by adding these electric circuits, right? That we can still have a perfect device. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. We're going to take this perfect device and try to build a potential that looks like this out of it. Yeah?
I just didn't see why the voltage should be zero.
Because Josephson said. Isn't that a bad answer? It's right here. Right? Remember that what happens is that we have a current which is given only by the phase difference across here. Right? So all the current flows through here, but there's no dissipation, there's no resistive element. So the voltage across that is zero. This thing looks like a superconducting wire. There's no resistance across a superconducting wire. So I mean, it looks as a part of this expression, you know, you have to take that expression as meaning one more thing. And this is the full story. There's no more. Right? So therefore, we haven't cheated you by not including a resistor. There's explicitly no resistance there. Good, thanks. So, let's take our circuit now. And have you remember your electronics. So all we're going to do is to put a current through here. Like so. Okay. And so now we have three currents going through here. The current through the junction, the current through the capacitor, and the current through the resistor, right? And Kirchhoff's laws will tell us that they better add up to the current that we apply. Yeah. So we have a simple piece. Well, the current through the junction we know, right? That's again given up there. And so we say that IJ is equal to the critical current times the sine of that phase. That's just the Josephson's equation. Ohm's law tells us that the current through the resistor is equal to V over R. Okay? But Josephson's expression gives us an expression for V. So we can replace this. With the time derivative of the face over the junction. For a capacitor, the current is the time derivative of the voltage times the capacitance. But if we already know what the voltage is, so we can take the time derivative of the voltage, and of course we'll just get a second order term here. And so this is going to be
Was
that?
Your two ICs, right? The different
ones.
It's critical and one is capacitor.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Thank you. Good. So this is, as just said, the critical current from Josephson's equation. Okay. So now we add one more condition over here, that IDC is equal to IR plus I through the junction plus I through the capacitor. Okay, and then we get this beautiful second order differential equation. To define the phase across the qubit, now, this might be familiar to you as looking at a driven harmonic oscillator. Does anyone work through that for driven harmonic oscillator? Maybe some? Okay. So then we would say, oh no, here I've got some total momentum term. Here, I have some piece which is the frictional damping. Sort of nice that the resistance shows up as it should be. And of course, here I have a drive term. And we can go through and look at that analysis. Let me not, because we're going to run out of time. And if you've seen it, I'll simply be repeating myself. If you haven't, we need to spend more time. So instead, let's ask the question of what happens as I start with the current at zero and I increase the current. So let's make a plot here. Of the phase and the DC current. We're going to start here. Now, if you've seen a driven harmonic oscillator, you've seen that it will oscillate for a while if the as you're increasing the drive term. And then it will go into make some crazy jumps. Yeah? Okay. Let's see what happens here. We start here and we slowly increase the current. What happens to the currents over this system? And let me plot here, actually, make this a little bit easier plot. Let's put the voltage. That's going to appear over this piece. Now, of course, these are in parallel, right? So the voltage over the junction is the same as the voltage over the resistor. It's the same as the voltage over the capacitor, right? Okay, so we start here. We slowly increase. What happens?
It increases.
What decreases?
No, it should increase.
What increases?
The current.
Okay. So absolutely. As I increase the current increases. What happens to the voltage?
It increases as well.
So up until the critical current, it's going to stay zero. Then we'll be with you. Remember that this piece here is going to look like a superconducting wire up until the point that we exceed the critical current. So let me label here IC. And we're going to go in this path here up to that point. Then we're going to end up jumping over here somewhere, and we'll start to have a linear rise of the voltage. So we'll introduce a voltage, it'll jump to a big value, and then the linear rise, now that is simply because you have that resistor term, right? So this just says, oh yes, I've got some resistance going on as well. All right, so we're going in this direction. When we come back down, we'll go down lower, and then we'll go this way. There's a hysteresis in this process. The hysteresis, because we have a term with momentum in this. And so the pendulum, the driven pendulum is swinging. And now you're saying, oh, no, I want to slow you down. But he says, oh, I have my momentum, I'll do what I want to do, right? And then eventually, okay, you catch up with this. So for homework, I'd like you to actually calculate these dynamics and to see this correctly, okay? And remember that the voltage here, remember that the voltage is a sinusoidally varying voltage, right? So it's the amplitude of a sinusoidally varying voltage. Now, this looks a little bit too much like electrical engineering. So we have this term, and what I'd like to do is to write it down as a term that I can extract the potential from. So what I'm going to do is write down the differential equation again in terms of the angle, but I'm going to group all the forces to one side. And then I can say that, oh yes, the force is minus the derivative of the potential. So I can define a potential. And then, being an experimentalist, I'll give myself the freedom to simply say, oh, that potential now becomes a Hamiltonian. Now, we can, of course, write down Lagrangians if you like. We'll come to exactly the same place. Okay? But let's forget it. So, we make a trivial change to the grouping of this. Okay. And now then I say, ah, this piece is the force, and it's minus the derivative of a potential. So we integrate that, and we have a potential as a function of phi of minus IC cosine phi minus IDC times phi. We get a periodic piece, and I get a linear term. So we plot this. So if I take it's nicest to renormalize this by dividing through by IDC, I think. No, I divide through by IC. Okay. So divide through by IC. So we end up with that piece. So now we just plot it. We say, ah, we have a cosine potential in the case that IDC is equal to zero. And now then, we'll see next class that we can calculate the number of levels that are trapped in there. Okay, so we have some structure. And then I can increase IDC, right? IDC is under our control, that it's actually a current source that we put in there. In fact, for this circuit, the only thing that we've given ourselves control over is IDC. Everything else is fixed. So now I can change that, and we'll end up with a tilted potential. And this is called in the field the tilted washboard potential. Just in case you ever saw the laundry room of your great-great-grandmother. And of course, we'll continue to do this. And if we take IDC equal to IC, then we have a critical point where the potential monotonically decreases over the system, right? So here there are no bound states. Right. So what happens? Up here, we have a small number of states. We can do quantum information processing. We still have to figure out how to get control over this, but we can make the potential that we like. As we tilt it, then we're going to have less bound states. And so if we were hanging out in one of these upper ones, then what's going to happen is we're going to fall down this potential. As we fall down the potential, then of course d phi dt is going to be non-zero. And if that's the case, somewhere over here, we get the voltage over the device. So we can make a measurement of what's going on in our system. If I can control here, then effectively I can end up using this as a measurement operator, use this for the coherent control. Okay? Now this is the simplest potential that we can get. And we'll see that we can get arbitrarily shaped potentials next class. Okay, but now then we say, okay, we'll take a simple system that we believe to have low noise, of course it's at low temperature, and that it has an inherent nonlinearity. And based upon that inherent nonlinearity, we can go and start to construct whichever Hamiltonian we like, right? And so this, we say, is the Hamiltonian as a function of phi. Okay, so now with that potential function, we can go ahead and start doing quantum information process.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll continue. Go through this problem just to show yourselves that the richness of this very simple case, okay, and to convince yourself that you understand all the dynamics in this stuff. Now, of course, Josephson's expressions here are not very well motivated, and the reason that of course, he had so many arguments with people is in his original papers, they're not very well motivated. They are a conclusion, but not from a very well-structured argument. As I said, Feynman later on derives them explicitly, taking an assumption just the form of the wave function, that if you have that wave function, then necessarily you'll have these sorts of dynamics. Of course, that wave function no longer is restricted to superconductors. So that in a normal conductor, provided you're in the ballistic regime, you can have very complementary sorts of dynamics. Okay, so we won't talk about that, but it's a richer set of physics than was appreciated a few years ago. Oh, and there's no class tomorrow. There'll be instead two classes on Thursday.